to just quickly go through some of the basic stuff, and then I'll show you a specific construction that we came up with. Now, if you look at the true random number generators, you can basically identify several components, building blocks, so-called. And basically, we start with an entropy source, and that's really the key, right? I mean, you have to have a high entropy source that lends itself for easy collection, harvesting. And some specific sources that were proposed and used in the past are thermal and shot noise in circuits. Like if you look at the resistance is not fixed, it's changing in time. Very little, but it does change, so you can tap into that. Brownian motion, and I think there was a esoteric lava lamp construction a few years back, came in the news and so on, completely useless. Nuclear decay, which maybe you can have very strong physical properties there and justifications for entropy, but the problem is, of course, you don't want to go through, you know, an airline check booth, you know, the nuclear decay device, TRNG, built into your cell phone. And quantum phenomena, which is the obvious place to go. Randomness is just built into quantum mechanics, and you know, if you look at photon polarization, and flux circuits, for example, in quantum computing, it is essentially randomness. And depending on how precise you can implement the your equipment, your measurement equipment, you can get fairly strong results on your entropy level in this game. And there are some commercial products out there that are actually doing just that. It's very easy to do, by the way. It's just build a photon polarization system and just measure it with an orthogonal basis. And the closer you get to the orthogonal basis in your measurement, the precision, the better results you get. So anyway, that's about the entropy source. Harvesting mechanism, which is really where most of the TRNGs fail. It's difficult to build decent mechanism for collecting that or harvesting that entropy source. And ideally, we'd like to have, at least at this point, you know, have some simple mechanism, not overly complicated, so that we can build justifications, if not proofs, on the output of that harvesting scheme. And in many cases, there is a post-processing step that is needed, and this is due to several reasons. It could be that the harvesting mechanism is not perfect, working perfectly well. Could be due to efficiency reasons, or it could be basically just, you know, you're scared and you don't want to rely on these two, and you want to have like one extra cryptographic step making things more difficult for an attacker in case your hardware breaks down. So it's also for fault resilience of your TRNG. And specific constructions, von Neumann corrector has been around for many, many years. Of course, he proposed this originally for uniformly processing roundings in arithmetic circuits. Very, very early. Many people from the arithmetic community, they will know this better than I do, but you can also do the same thing. It's essentially processing the bit distribution by sacrificing some bits. You can get closer to uniformity. But it's a very basic, very simple scheme. Much more sophisticated ways of doing this. And most interesting family of extractor functions were proposed a few years back in chess. And extractor functions are complexity theoretical constructions which essentially say that if you can quantify the input distribution and if you can show that there's at least a minimum number of bits that are random, not necessarily bits, but could be spread, so there's some level of randomness in the source, then the output distribution of the extractor function, it can be guaranteed to be epsilon close to a particular distribution with, you know, the specifics of how much randomness should be in the source and, you know, what kind of a epsilon you could get at the output distribution. That's a whole different field in itself. But the nice thing is there are tons of extractor functions around. So that's a nice theoretical construction that also gives you some provability aspects. And what you can do otherwise, if you don't want to go through all the methods, you can just use the cryptographic functions like SHA, MD5, and so on. The problem is by doing so, you're breaking your chain of proofs, let's say. You want to be able to go back through all these steps back to the source and see, you know, by making basic assumptions on the source, what kind of output you get. And with SHA, you're essentially stuck with something that is difficult to quantify in terms of input-output properties. You can just make statistical arguments, that's it. Okay. As we have seen in the previous talk, testing challenges is difficult, and it's a beautiful cartoon by Scott Adams that just very nicely captured the difficulty of doing so, but essentially you're not testing, because we only have access to the output for a finite duration, not necessarily a characterization of the source, there's only so much you can do. And what typically PRNG designers do is to do the next best thing, which is to use PRNG tests, pseudo random number generator tests. And these are only there to check the statistical properties of the output distribution. And two particularly popular families of tests, and I say families, but if you look inside, DieHard contains maybe more than 20 different individualized tests coming more from statistics. And that's Marsaglia's test suite. And there's also a NIST test suite. So these are the two popular tests. And that has been deemed sufficient in the past, not like a few years ago. And what people were doing, they were designing the hardware system that's probably had some source in mind and some intuition. It was more like an art form. And then you take the output, run it through NIST and DieHard. If it doesn't pass, you sample a little bit more, you know, slowly, with leaving more between your samples. At some point, if there is a source of entropy, then it will be able to pass the NIST and DieHard test, and that will seem sufficient. But that's no longer true. So with that perspective in mind, and the German BSI just pioneered in this work by producing the AIS standard. And it's a short document, basically says that the designers puts the burden on the designer to provide a testing methodology when they, you know, submit a design, rather than coming up with a test suite. So it doesn't exactly solve the problem, but it steps in the right direction. It says, you know, you're designing the system, what is the testing methodology? What kind of test should I use to, you know, evaluate your design? And of course, that's not the only way to do that. There's some other things as well that I'm gonna mention later on. But NIST also has been having sessions, discussion sessions and so on. It's an ongoing work. And it looks like when and if this comes with a final version of their standard for true random number generation, it will be partially based on the German BSI's AIS effort. So anyway, and if you look at the German BSI's effort, it looks like it's overlapping to some extent by Kilman and Schindler's work. And they were very early on the right spot in terms of testing TRNGs. And they specifically came up with several tests that are kind of nice. They have, at least they capture some of the things you like to see in a TRNG. For example, the top test, which is just a short form of saying, that stands for the family of tests that you can use to identify or to catch if the TRNG has a breakdown in the randomness source. Like if there is something seriously wrong, like if there is, let's say the power circuit is no longer functional. So that there's a noise breakdown, obviously. And so basically it says the entropy source is no longer good. Startup test is, or restart test is essentially, you have this device, and if it's a true TRNG, and it doesn't say how good or bad it is, if you restart it, it shouldn't produce the same sequence. Which is true, right? I mean, everybody will say that's true. And actually, this leads to somewhat of a metric If you have a bad TRNG, if you run it twice, it may start at the same location, but in a few iterations, the entropy or the randomness kicks in, and maybe after 100 cycles, you start seeing different bits. The question becomes, how soon do you have that avalanche effect? Or how soon is the randomness visible at the output? And another class of tests are the so-called online tests, which essentially says, you have this TRNG, and you know, you put it in a chip, it's fabricated, send out, and build in devices. And it would be nice to actually have some kind of alarm signal on that device. It just says, okay, the TRNG doesn't work anymore. So you have to have some kind of extra component in your TRNG built next to your TRNG that does continual testing. And these are not necessarily separate. For example, you can tie this to the online test. The startup test is kind of, maybe perhaps you will also be able to tie the startup to online test. But this is an area that is essentially unexplored, online tests. And I want to give you a survey. I say survey, it's definitely incomplete. Many references are missing. And what I'm going to show you is just a few representative designs that were proposed in the past. And they come from all sorts of different ideas, so it's kind of interesting to see, you know, these different ideas. In 1999, this is an early work, essentially, in this area, which is kind of still not settled yet. Bagini, Bucci, I hope I'm pronouncing their names correctly, went with the obvious. They took junction noise, the resistance, and goes through low-pass filters. There's a sampling switch, you sample it, and you compare it with hysteresis on an op-amp. And you have a counter which down samples. And this is the sampling circuit, of course. And the problem is, well, not problem quite yet. And the idea is, it has this built-in online protection scheme, so it's like, if we don't really get good bits out, let's slow down our sampling. It's kind of, it counts numbers ones and zeros, and it adjusts the output accordingly, or the sampling speed, let's say. It's a cute idea, but the problem is, if you do post-processing based on the data, you're introducing biases into the data itself. And it's very difficult to analyze what the output distribution is going to be in such a case. But it was an early effort, and at least get something started. And the Intel TRNG is fairly popular because it's easy to reach analysis of the paper. In many cases, TRNGs are not even made public. The companies don't like to do that, basically. And this is out in the public because Paul Kocher and his team did some analysis, and they wrote a report about it. And in the Intel TRNG, which is kind of old now, but they have a new one, they essentially go through the same process, but instead of online processing or corrections, frequency corrections, which is something you shouldn't do, they basically sample the VCO that is randomly modulated with the noise from the junction, which is amplified. And with the high-speed oscillator, they're sampling that. So there is no correction, which is kind of good. And then there's a sampling circuit, and you get the data into a FIFO. And here you see it says digital correctors. They have a von Neumann corrector here, which is nice. And then there's an extra step, which is just running the whole output through a SHA. So. Again, it's nice. I don't. I think in some sense it's solid, but the problem is you don't have. You can't build a security proof chain or analysis, let's say mathematical analysis, because you're in the end you're still stuck with SHA. Yes.
What's
the corrector is a von Neumann function, and it also says they're also using SHA in it. So it's kind of vague as the source we have. It's hashing, yeah. Another construction by Fisher and Zutarovsky, which was also, I think, in the previous talk, And I think they have new versions now. This is a relatively old version from a few years ago. Uses a PLL circuit, and the idea is, you know, Altera chipsets have PLLs built. Well, some of the families have PLLs built into them. So why not use a PLL for an analog source for randomness, as an analog source for randomness, and just construct a sampling method based on that? So this is more of an electrical engineering approach. It's kind of similar to the previous construction, the one before the Intel TRNG. The unique thing about this construction was that it was the first time somebody proposed to actually build a TRNG on an FPGA, on a reconfigurable platform. And that's why it was seen as largely useful, because, you know, before it was like you have to build a custom ASIC to do so. In that sense, it was great. They also have some reconfigurable sampling parameters that you can change on the fly, which is kind of nice. It's not necessarily post-processing. This is just adjusting the sampling rate, and these rates do not depend, at least in real time, on the output distribution or number of ones and zeros. They're not counted. In that sense, it's nice. One thing that is problematic here is that you're using a combination of analog and digital devices, like PLL, and the rest of the circuit is digital. What that means is you have to do either mixed design, or, for example, you can't use this with Xilinx FPGAs that don't have a PLL. But it was definitely a step in the right direction in terms of getting this into FPGAs. I'm sorry for the image, it's a little bit blurred, but I can, you know, just point out what this is. This is a very interesting construction by Tzatzik from Motorola. What he's doing here is he has two oscillators, which is nice, and you have jitter and oscillators, so the clock edges are not exactly sharp. They may come epsilon before the expected edge or epsilon after. What that means is you introduce randomness, and these are actually the clock inputs, one to an LFSR, standard LFSR, and one for a cellular automata network. So it's kind of an interesting mix here. You have an LFSR and a cellular automata, and they're clocked with oscillators that have jitter in them. That's the source of randomness. It's kind of similar to the shrinking generator in terms of, you know, the idea of using the oscillators for clocking. And these are two sampling networks, and eventually you just XOR the value, and XOR, that's the standard technique to improve biases in the output because of the piling up lemma. The problem is that it's very difficult to come up with any security justification analysis when you have a scheme like this, highly heterogeneous and difficult to analyze. Here's another construction by Epstein and a bunch of other authors whose names I don't remember, unfortunately. And basically, they use metastability, two types of sources of randomness. That's the originality of the scheme. And they use metastability in memory cells together with inverter rings, but they merge them in a single architecture by using switches. So depending on the clocking, it's either a memory cell or an oscillator ring with inverters. It's kind of a neat trick, and that's the basic cell, and they replicate this many, many times and sample the whole thing after they XOR the results together. And it gives nice output, but only when you use many of these cells, a large number of these cells. And the question is, you know, what's the analysis? And again, as before, they use Dynhart and NIST to justify, you know, look at the output stream and so on. And there's no probability aspect here as well. Okay. So I'm done with surveying some of the constructions. And I know that there's some other constructions, like I know that people are looking into Galois and Fibonacci configuration. Essentially, LFSR is in a slightly different configuration for randomness. And it seems promising, but the problem there again is there is no analysis for the output. So anyway, here's somewhat of a wish list that I compiled. You know, somebody as an engineer who actually wants to use this. And the other thing is the TRNG is really the root of the system. If we find, if we start building TRNGs into trusted applications, for example, and TPMs and so on, it's really critical that they're really solid. So one of the big problems that we have seen over and over again in all these constructions is that they're extremely difficult to test. It's extremely difficult to test these designs because the designs are not simple enough. They're fairly complicated. You have different components coming from different types of math and so on, like cellular automata mixed with LFSRs that are clocked asynchronously, or you have cryptographic functions that are smuggled into your circuit. It might make sense as a post-processing method at the very end, after you have gone through the steps of justifying your collection mechanism, but not before that. They must come with a security proof, and I'm saying security proof here, you know, I'm using those, that phrase a little bit loosely, because in the end it's going to be a reduction. You won't ever have a full security proof, but if you can reduce it to basic assumptions that we know hold true, and we can justify them from, you know, the particular discipline that analyzes the entropy source. Like if it's jitter, then it could be VLSI designers who have been studying this effect for many, many years, and they have very strong characterizations and analytical models for the behavior of the jitter event. And we also don't want complicated post-processing that makes it, again, difficult to prove anything. And it's also a wish due to efficiency, right? I mean, if you have to complicate, we want these devices into embedded systems, built into embedded systems in many, many places that have different operating conditions. We need to be able to have scalable architectures that can be made compact. So we don't want complicated post-processing, and preferably digital. For example, the PLL idea, it was a nice start, but the problem is if you want to build this on Xilinx, FPGAs, or even just from a process and cost perspective, rather than going with a mixed IC process for manufacturing, you might want to just stick with a digital design and use only one set of tools and so on. So no analog components, please. And which brings us to our construction. And this is I have two co-authors, Martin and Stinson. They're both mathematicians. Stinson from Waterloo and Martin from WPI. And we looked at, we wanted to come up with a TRNG that has a full and decent analysis attached with it. So we wanted to follow what we have, you know, constructed up in the previous slides. And therefore, we needed a source, a reliable source that everybody uses that you can obtain in digital circuits. And obviously, jitter is pretty much the, and maybe metastability would be another candidate for that. And jitter is basically, let's assume you have a clock circuit. These edges will not be perfect. They will move maybe a little bit back. And that's due to process noise in your manufacturing, your semiconductor process noise and terminal noise. And because of that, you won't have sharp edges here. They will move a little bit. So you have this variation. And that's the reason that we're interested in this waveform. Rest is deterministic. They don't contribute anything to our design. And this is the design. It's fairly simple. You just take a bunch of oscillators. And the basic good old way of building clocks, for example, in circuits before we have crystals, we're using just an odd number of inverters chained together, and you see that 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. Of course, it will be, if you have an odd number of inverters, you have the clock effect. It will keep switching. It will alternate. And you just XOR them together, and then you sample it. It's as simple as that. And when you do that, you're essentially, and this is one of those edges that we saw in the previous slide, in the waveform. If you look more closely at the jitter event, which is basically the indeterminacy in in exactly where this edge is going to come. There is a distribution, of course. If you characterize the signal, the waveform, many, many times, you will get something that is Gaussian. Okay, you will get a distribution map that is Gaussian. And the jitter events, we define it, for example, in our case, and you can change it, of course. We define it as around the mean to be about 0.7 epsilon plus and minus sigma, sorry, where sigma is the standard distribution. And if you do that, you can calculate that the entropy that you get out of this event is 0.8 bits of randomness. Okay. And of course, if you go for more sigma, higher sigma, you will get more randomness, or get a better entropy. But the problem is you're making your... it will affect performance eventually. Okay. And the problem is if you're... I'm going to go back a couple of slides. This is one oscillator, right? This is the output of one oscillator. If you XOR it with another one, you will get more of these regions, maybe, if they're off by phase, half phase period. You will get more so-called jitter zones. And so we keep populating the spectrum by adding more oscillators. The question is, when we sample, with what probability are we going to get a sample from this region where the bit value is not... predictable. And because you have an analog process and difficult to analyze, we build a model. And the model is this. Rather than assuming we have an analog spectrum, we assume we have a discrete one. So in a sense, we're assuming we have bins adjacent to each other. And each jitter corresponds to a ball that you're showing. So if you throw a ball, it fills one bin maybe, right? One bin, definitely. And the question is, how many balls do we have to throw until we have one ball in each of these bins? With high probability, of course. You can say infinity if you want to be sure, always. But with high probability, how many balls do we need to throw until we fill maybe 100 of these bins? And that 100 depends on how many rings you have, and that will depend on the standard deviation or divided by the rate of the standard deviation with respect to the period of your jitter. So anyway, so we have this new model now, which is nice. It's easier to analyze, and it's a combinatorial model, obviously. And it turns out this is very similar to the coupon collector problem that has been around for many, many years, a well-studied problem in discrete math, which is exactly the same problem in a cast in a different way, so I'm not going to repeat it. And you can make a very simple analysis, and you find that the expected value of the number of throws is in the order of n log n, where n is the number of urns you have, or number of bins you have. So, which is fine. And here, in our setting, n will be determined by the ratio of sigma with respect to a period. Because, you know, each jitter contributes a ball that is filling a bin that is sigma wide, you know, compared to a period. Okay. So the question becomes, with what probability, you know, assume we use this many rings, okay, with what confidence level can we say that each of these bins will be filled? This is good as an initial approximation, and it tells you how this is going to grow, but doesn't give us a confidence value. And therefore, we cannot use this for entropy estimates at the output. So we need something more than that. And we have... I think a little bit of a more complicated model here. We are defining the minimum number of rings as a function m in terms of, that is given in terms of the number of urns or bins, the fill rate, what percentage we want to fill. So we're introducing this fill rate. Before we were shooting for completely filling it, and then we get the expected number. But if you make this into a parameter, now we can have probability estimates. And then the probability that this will happen. So essentially, one way to read this is the number of rings necessary that the event, at least fn, f times n, are filled with probability at least p. And that's the function m. Yes?
You wanted the m to be capital N, the third length?
Excuse me?
In the first point in the third line, are you talking about M ones or capital N?
You're right, it should be capital. The problem is we introduce yet another post-processing step and that becomes M. Here it's still that capital N, you're right. It will become M later on, and that's what will, and that's why I have this, it shouldn't be in this slide yet. You're right, it should be capital N. N earns. So anyway, for f equals 1, this is the coupon collector problem, so it's kind of a generalization of that. And the problem is, this has been studied for 50, 60 years. It's been around for a long time, and nobody's been able to find a closed form expression for m. But there are good news. There are different ways of computing this recursively. Okay. So anyway, make a new definition, PNRF. And that denotes the probability that at least fn out of n earns are filled with exactly r rings. And here you don't necessarily have to follow this, but it's a simple function theory argument. You're counting the number of functions that will make this probability happen. And by that, we are normalizing this according to by the number of all functions to find a probability. So anyway, there are n to the r functions from an r set to an n set, and this gives us, in our setting, the total number of ways associated for each ring to fill one of the n urns. And then the number of onto functions among these n to the r functions is given by, you can compute this by inclusion-exclusion. And if you do that, the number of functions f with an image size of at least fn, we are always going for the bound, of course, is given by the summation. And then we just have to normalize it with respect to the number of functions that you can build. Okay? And if you do that, this gives us PNRF. From PNRF, we can compute the minimal number, MNRF. Which we did. And by the way, the details of this mathematical analysis in the papers, in our paper, which is online, you can just go to our webpage, crypto.wpa.edu, and download it from there, if you're interested in learning more the analysis. I've just summarized with two slides, but in the paper it's a page. Okay, so if you take that model and build the recursive formula and compute it through, this is what you get. Here we have the fill rate, if you want like 95%, of the urns to be filled, or of your spectrum to be filled, or in other terms, if you're sampling from one bit from each urn, then 95% of the bits that you get, you want that to be random. In that case, of course, it's not going to be perfectly random. With confidence level 99%, you need 291 rings. Oscillator rings. Okay? And this is for a particular case, of course, for n equal 36 urns. So by using this table or constructing different versions of this table by looking at different n, and n is determined, of course, by the standard deviation of your jitters, you're able to pinpoint exactly how many rings you need. So that's good. Problem is, though, if you look at this table closely, if you want to go for higher fill rates, you're paying a lot. You see, for example, we go from 50% to 95% fill rate by going by increasing the area of our design sevenfold. That's a lot. You pay a lot. So the question is, can we do better? And we can do better by using so-called resilient functions. So rather than filling the entire spectrum with jitter, let's assume we go with something less, let's say with 50%, so we use only 26 rings, But downsample, and we do that downsampling using resilient functions which have provable characteristics. And anyway, a resilient function is defined mathematically, as given here. I'm not going to go through the definition, but essentially resilient functions were motivated primarily by, you know, by cryptography. The idea is if an attacker knows part of your key, how much, then is it still possible to build cryptographic functions by maybe processing that key, your key input? So you have an extra function, and resilient functions do a really good job in terms of ensuring that the statistical properties are preserved. So anyway, one thing that you should know about resilient functions is the parameterization. N is the input, M is the output of the resilient function. N is large, M is small, and T is the resiliency degree. Resilient functions allow you to preserve the statistical uniformity of your bits if, or up to T bits. If T or more, if more than T bits are compromised, your resilient function doesn't do you any good. But if it's limited, the compromise limited up to T bits, then you can still perform perfectly. And a nice way to construct a simple construction of resilient functions is achieved by using an NMD linear code. And the function is simply defined as a vector matrix product where the matrix G is the generator of the linear code. And then you automatically get an NMD minus one, you lose only one bit, a resilient function. So T here is D minus one. So we are tying a resilient function fully to a linear code. And then we did some calculations for large Fn, the output entropy of a resilient function in our setting with the fill rate and then so on, is PFN in short, without the resilient function, sorry. And if you use the resilient function, it's M times P. Remember, M is the length of the output. And unfortunately, we don't have closed form expressions, so we can't really tell how the performance changes when you introduce the resilient function in an analytic way. But from experimentation, we have seen that it's great in terms of improving the performance. And that's intuitive, basically, because from here, for example, you're shifting your operating point down to here, and then you sacrifice just some bits. So you sacrifice maybe half of your bits, but use 1/7 of your circuit area. Okay, so it's a speed performance trade-off, area trade-off. So anyway, if you do that, I have an example here that just takes you through the entire construction for particular sigma value, which we have established by measurements. So anyway, I'm not going to go through the whole thing. But basically, we use an extended PCH code for the resilient function. And with the resilient function, one nice outcome that I want to point out here is if you build your resilient function to be stronger than maybe here, for example, you just need to be able to, if you pick this operating point, you need the resilient function of strength 50, right, at the output. So 50%, it should be able to handle 50% of deterministic inputs at the input. If you over-design it a little bit, you get resiliency features. So if your RNG starts to fail or if somebody injects faults, because of the extra resiliency that you bring in with your resilient function, you're getting an extra space, margin of tolerance for either environmental variation or adversarial faults. And it's a very simple thing to calculate that. You can exactly quantify the level. One nice thing was while we were developing this mathematical framework and so on, we put our the original version of our paper online, the preliminary version. We have an independent verification. Nice thing is that two of the authors are here in the audience now, and they actually took our design, the framework, implement on FPGA, and paper was published. And the nice thing is, to a certain extent, it confirmed our results. There were a few couple of minor points we needed to work out, which were slightly different. And it turned out in practice, you can actually maybe, you may be able to do better, run it at higher frequencies. We are very conservative in our analysis and numbers we picked and so on. So the question is it over design? Can we do actually better? So anyway, this is the conclusion. I'm done. We presented the TRNG design that is based on sampling phase jitter and oscillator circuits. It's a simple design. And under mild assumptions, which is at the very basic level of the jitter characteristics, the distribution, will generate probably random bits. And of course, I'm abusing the probability aspect. Because you have to be careful. I mean, you have to still state all the assumptions next to it. And it provides some tolerance to adversarial manipulation. We can change that. And we're able to get around the exponential increase. Well, it's not exactly, not necessarily exponential, but at least it looks so, because we don't have a closed form expression. We cannot tell for sure if it's exponential. We obtained constant factor improvement by throwing in the resilient function for post-processing. And the resulting architecture is scalable. You can do a lot of, you have so many different operating points. You use less oscillators, make your area more compact, but you use a stronger resilient function, which doesn't add much to the area. But the resilient function will be sacrificing millibits to produce a decent output. So it will downsample quite a bit. So you have speed area trade-offs that you can play with this TRNG. And from the implementations results, with reasonable area, we're getting megabit per second switch output. And but there's a lot of room for improvement. The question is, for example, perhaps we can use more complicated oscillators like the ones in Galois and Fibonacci constructions, again with the same approach, with probability and so on. And we may be able to get better results in performance. That's one direction. The other question is, in practice, we actually implement it and you start playing with folds and so on. What's the resiliency in actual experimentation? And that's it.